There are those of you who are here, and I'm glad to have you guys here tonight. If I mentioned last week that if I pointed you to the John Cleese recordings on YouTube, that there were some missing ones, and I have now uploaded the missing letters. So hopefully you got an email from Crystal, but there's a clear YouTube link to a channel where the four or five missing Cleese letters are present, and you can listen to those as well. I wonder as I listen to them if they're actually a different recording. The sound quality is a little different, and his voice sounds older. So I don't know if he recorded them in two different times. It doesn't matter to me if you've thought about that or not, but I think it's funny. So this is our second to last night. We're going to talk about, like we did last week, I will talk first. We'll take a short break, and then we'll have a chance for discussion and group conversation at the end of that. You bring whatever questions you have, and we'll try and talk through those things. Tonight's topic is we're going to talk about the rational animal. I've got the sex and the human creature down. That's how we'll focus. And if you're flipping through the quotes, you'll see there's lots of interesting stuff. The quotations, I'm supposed to say. You'll see there's lots of interesting stuff that we're going to deal with. Okay. So I'd like to begin. If you'd like, if you could open to letter 19. Obviously page numbers are not worth it, but letter 19, and I'm going to read from the last paragraph of letter 19. It may be on your notes as well, but it's worth us looking at together. So he's Screwtape's taken up the challenge of whether falling in love matters or not. And Wormtongue's asking, should I make him fall in love? And Wormtongue Screwtape is upset. He's like, this is the wrong kind of question. You know, let them worry about love or patriotism or celibacy or candles and altars. There's no answer. Nothing matters at all except the tendency of a given state of mind and given circumstances to move a particular patient at a particular moment nearer the enemy or nearer to us. And so the move of distraction in love is very, very important. And at the very last sentence he says, or second to last sentence, in the meantime, get it quite clear in your own mind that this state of falling in love is not in itself necessarily favorable either to us or to the other side. It is simply an occasion which we and the enemy are both trying to exploit. Like most of the other things which humans are excited about, such as health and sickness, age and youth, or war and peace, it is, from the point of view of the spiritual life, mainly raw material. Now, the kind of opening that we talked about with this is to highlight the fact that there is a spiritual world and a material world, and in Lewis's understanding of those worlds, the spiritual has priority. The spiritual world is the main world, and we think this business of the war, the European war, is what matters, but the real war is the war for souls. And the material world is a subset, is not the correct word, but like a reflection. The stuff that happens here has impact, but it's not the main thing. It's battleground. And I remind you, of course, that as a spirit, the devil is a spirit and devils are spirits. They don't have bodies. They don't have any access to physical pleasure. There's no concept of it for them. Physical pleasure is something that we as human animals have access to and something that God in his sovereignty has created. And so sex for demons doesn't mean anything to them except for how they can distort you in response to it. It's just material. Just like gluttony or food doesn't mean anything. It's just what they can do to you through it is what's mattering. So my thesis that's kind of governing us today is this. I believe, and many church fathers believe with me, that lust is the least serious of all sins. It's kind of generally agreed upon in church history. But it is a backdoor through which many other sins can enter in our spiritual lives. So those are kind of the things I'm going to try. I give you that headline, but that's where I'm going to start off and where we're going to land. So I'm going to talk about what it means to be human, how sin distorts the human picture, the role of sexual sin within the catalog of sins, how Lewis addresses the situation, and then we'll come back or we'll reference Screwtape throughout. So the plate's full. Buckle up. Hopefully the notes are adequate so you've got all the stuff you need for us to go through this. So this first section is something called theological anthropology, and I need to begin by describing what the human creature is, what we are. And there's actually a recipe for the human creature in the book of Genesis. Genesis 2:7, the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. All right, if you want to create a human, apparently, it is a combination of dust plus spirit, okay? That's how you make a human. There's a great old preacher's joke about the scientists who finally get together and form a human out of the material. They gather them, form it, build them together, and animate it, comes along, and they say, "Guess what, God? We finally made our own human." And God looked down and says, "Yeah, get your own dust." You realize, oh, you made it all. So there are some, I don't want to belabor this too much, but the Genesis account resembles, there are temple stories in the ancient world, and the Genesis account looks a great deal like these temple stories. And part of what's being said is other cultures build temples, and the last thing you put in the temple is the image of the god. And the last thing you do to the image of the god is you awaken that image in a public ceremony by opening its mouth and its eyes and breathing on it. And the Genesis story says, no, I make the temple, the universe, the earth. I put my image in the temple, me, and I awaken it by my ceremony, breathing on it. And so there's something very polemic about Genesis 1 and 2 that I think when we read it in overly scientific terms, we miss that there's something about who we are in the universe, which is why, one of the first moral commandments is if I violate the image of God, then I die, right? Because what I've just done is I've committed sacrilege against the image of God in his palace temple, the universe. And so murder is a form of sacrilege. And I think that's very important for us to understand. Anyway, so we got a recipe. Dust plus the Spirit of God is how you want to make a human. And this is the amphibian nature of the human creature. Screwtape letter 7, you've got this in your notes. Screwtape says it. Humans are amphibians. Half spirit, half animal. Half dust, half spirit. The enemy's determination to produce such a revolting hybrid was one of the things that determined our father's withdrawal of his support from him. As spirits, they belong to the eternal world, but as animals, they inhabit time. This means that while their spirit can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change, for to be in time means to change. We are material stuff. We're created things. We're dust. We're dirt. We're the same as this. That's us. But we're animated by the Spirit of God, which makes us not this stuff. And there's something that transforms it. We've got this God's breath animating. We're animated by the very life and power of God himself. And so there's the dust plus the spirit, there's a right relationship of this. So in the created order, and again, according to Lewis's understanding of the spiritual world, which I think is right, we have spirit, okay, in a state of priority over the dust. You could say this is the Spirit of God in control of the material world. This is our spirits in control of our bodies. This is the will in control of your physical nature. That's the right relationship. And what happens in part in the third chapter of Genesis is that in the fall, in the act of disobedience by Adam, Adam places the dust in priority over the spirit. And he listens, so this gets reversed, okay? And so he listens to, formally he listens to his wife, but they're listening to the creation, they're listening to their appetites, they're listening to a desire for knowledge, listening to something in the created world rather than listening to God. And this is the fundamental break in reality for our experience of it. The world is made to be a place where the Spirit of God hovers over the waters, where the Spirit of God hovers in our lives over our material nature, and we now live in a place where this has been disordered, and our material nature is in control. And so there's weakness on our part. It distorts the creature. Romans 2, 21 through 25 probably describes this very passage in some ways. Paul speaking, I don't know if he's speaking about all creatures, about Jews, or about Adam, probably a little bit of everything. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God nor give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them, for they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Worshipped and served our own nature, our own dust. We answered the world rather than responding to God who made the world. And that's the fall. That's the beginning of everything wrong with humanity. And I think I just want to point out that this is not, we'll come back to this, I suppose, but it's important to see that, the story of Christ is that Christ reorders this relationship correctly. So Christ comes, he's the perfect human, he has the right relationship between spirit and flesh, he's tempted, as humans were, by Satan, and he resists the temptation. The temptation is to prioritize his needs over obedience to the Father, and he chooses obedience to the Father, even obedience unto death. And this radical obedience unto death is what resets our relationship with God. That's one way to understand the saving work of Christ. And now what he does is that in salvation, he offers you the Holy Spirit of God who indwells you and enables you to live the right relationship between spirit and flesh that you're supposed to have. And that's most of Paul's teaching in the New Testament. That's what he's on about. The Corinthians, I get too excited, I'll shut up. Anyway, the Corinthians thought about being what they called spiritual men, psychikoi, and they went too far. They didn't understand it, and Paul's correcting their understanding of what it means to be spiritual. Okay, so why is this understanding of our human makeup and spiritual physiology important? Well, because the meeting point between the material and spiritual is a weak point. The seam that we still have, it's uneven, right? There's a seam, and there's a weak point, and Screwtape frequently highlights it. I'll just highlight a couple things. I won't read the passage, but letter 15, remember his discussion of eternity and time? Made for eternity, but living in time? That's a seam between the spiritual and material. It's an awkward point. Letter 2 on page 22, early in the temptation, he writes, all the habits of the patient, both mental and bodily, are still in our favor. In other words, he's had some kind of spiritual renewal, but his entire physical nature is still under the control. So we can work the seam between the spiritual and physical nature to do these things. Letter 4, at the very least, they could be persuaded that the bodily position in prayer makes no difference to their prayers, for they constantly forget what you must always remember, that they are animals. And what affects their bodies do affects their souls. Excuse me, whatever their bodies do affects their souls. It is funny how mortals always picture us putting things into their minds. In reality, our best work is done by keeping things out. Okay. So again, do you see how Screwtape is frequently, he's putting the thin end of the wedge at the material-spiritual divide, and that's where he's trying to create tension in following God. Because if he can make you fully focus on the material and neglect the spiritual, he's won. And if he can make you fully focus on the spiritual and neglect the material, he's won. And the difficulty is being holistic humans in the image of God, serving in the Spirit, having a sense of wholeness in this. It's hard, and maintaining that that central space. Okay. But the best thing he can do, the best thing Satan and the evil one can do, is to get us sin spiritually by means of our material nature. And that's maybe a complex sentence, and I'll come back to that, but he wants us to sin in spiritual ways because those are the more gratifying sins in some ways. Like I've said, lust is a sin, but it's not the most important of sins. So letter 20, you don't have this in your notes, so if you just read 19, let's go to 20, and the final two paragraphs of 20 I want to read for us at the moment. Okay, so there's one semi-long paragraph and a short one. That is the general strategy of the moment, but inside that framework, you will find it possible to encourage your patient's desires in one of two directions. You will find, if you look carefully into any human's heart, that he is haunted by at least two imaginary women, a terrestrial and an infernal Venus, and that his desire differs qualitatively according to its object. I'm sorry, I'm just laughing that he says, at least two imaginary haunted. Okay, sorry, at least. Could be as many as 50 imaginary women haunting you, in which case I want to recommend that you seek prayer. There is one type for which his desire is such as to be naturally amenable to the enemy, readily mixed with charity, readily obedient to marriage, colored all through that golden light of reverence and naturalness which we detest. There is another type which he desires brutally and desires to desire brutally, a type best used to draw him away from marriage altogether, but which even within marriage he would tend to treat as a slave, an idol, or an accomplice. His love for the first might involve what the enemy calls evil, but only accidentally. The man would wish that she was not someone else's wife and be sorry that he could not love her lawfully. But in the second type, the felt evil is what he wants. It's that tang and the flavor of which he is after. In the face, it is the visible animality or sulkiness or craft or cruelty which he likes, and in the body, something quite different from what he ordinarily calls beauty, something he may even in a sane hour describe as ugliness, but which by our art can be made to play on the raw nerve of his private obsession. The real use of the infernal Venus is no doubt as prostitute or mistress, but if your man is a Christian, and if he has been well-trained in nonsense about irresistible and all-excusing love, he can be induced to marry her. And that is very well worth bringing about. You will have failed as regards fornication and solitary vice, but there are other and more indirect methods of using a man's sexuality to his undoing. And by the way, they are not only efficient, but delightful. The unhappiness produced is of a very lasting and exquisite kind. What we're hinting at is that we can use sexuality to make you malicious and prideful and uncharitable and cruel. And those things are much more fruitful in the spiritual realm. In some ways, it's small peas, the sexual sin. The big stuff is the hatred you have for your neighbor now. Okay? So Screwtape's willing to trade A for B. That's partly what he's saying. Hopefully this will become clear quite what he means by some of these things in a moment. Okay, so I need to talk about sin for a few moments. You've got three theses down there. They'll go pretty quickly. So thesis one is that sin separates us from God and causes our spiritual death. This is kind of standard Christian theology. We saw it in Romans 2, choosing to prioritize the creation over the creator. We sever our connection to God. I mean, this inversion caused death to enter in. But it wasn't obviously immediate physical death. It was a spiritual death of the human creature because we rejected the priority of the Spirit. Okay, and that sin has what we see. It's lovely, actually, in Genesis 3. Lovely is the wrong word, but lovely, it's the poetry of it is elegant. Adam takes from the fruit, Eve takes from the fruit, Adam takes from Eve. Immediately, Adam blames Eve. It's the woman you gave me. That was a great, how do you think they lived down that argument for the rest of their lives? Eve blamed the snake by proxy God. It's your fault for putting the snake here, God. And then God punishes them he just declares the break. Okay, now you die. You'll have enmity with one another. You'll have enmity with the land, what you produce, and you're going to experience shame. And I think that's what the fall produces. We're broken with God. We're broken with our partners in life. We're broken in our work, and we have a brokenness within ourselves. And it's categorical, running all the way through. Okay, so that's the separation, and of course, then we are exiled and die. Thesis two, all sin is equal in its power to separate us from God. James chapter 2, verse 10 says this, "For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point." So in that respect, it doesn't matter which commandment you break, you're stuffed. So in one respect, all sin is equal in its ability to separate us from God. That means that deception, theft, sex outside of marriage, murder, pride, all the same. They all have the same power to separate us from God and invite spiritual death into our lives. So in that respect, all sin is equal. But third thesis is this, not all sin is equal in its harms to ourselves and others. So I think we have to acknowledge that there is inequality in how some sins harm ourselves and harm other people around us. Some sins are like spiritual acid, like wrath. Anne Lamott says that bitterness is like drinking rat poison and waiting for the rat to die. Okay, you build it up inside yourself, you've got this anger and frustration, right? The only person you're hurting is you. So it's a sin because you're harming yourself in that way. But it doesn't harm anyone else, right? You can be bitter as you want. You can hole up in your house and just be bitter at everyone around you. And so it's nominal in terms of the harm it does to other people, perhaps. The liabilities change in every context. Other sins have wide social effect, like gossip. It's really easy to gossip, right? But you could destroy a person's life. Very wide-ranging effects. In terms of how these things, you get the idea. I don't have to illustrate too much. This is some of the faulty logic behind what acts as permission for people. No one got hurt. No one knows. It's none of your business. Well, if all sin is equal before God, and I'm concerned about your well-being eternally, it is my business, right? And it doesn't mean that doesn't actually mean no one got hurt, because you are getting hurt by it, even if you can't see its effects right now. So we can talk about these things. Now, understanding our makeup, the amphibian nature as humans, gives an enriched understanding of how sin impacts our lives. So if the spiritual world sits in priority over the material, spirit over these things, then it follows that spiritual sins are worse than physical sins. Now, I've said that in the context of saying all sin separates from God, but the harms, some of the spiritual sins are considered worse. Now, for as long as the church has thought about categories of sin, you guys have heard of the seven deadly sins, right? As long as they've thought about these categories, they've always ranked them. They've always ranked them. And do you know what the worst one is? Okay, pride. Pride is always the worst. Okay? And you know what the least bad one is? I already told you, didn't I? Lust. Okay? And in between, there's some debate about what goes where, but wrath is here. I think envy is here. I think greed is in the middle. Greed and covetousness are some of the words are. Sloth. These are, depending on how you interpret them, these get switched. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Gluttony. And lust. Okay? So however they rank, I mean, there's disagreements about, this isn't like a sacred order, but it's pretty much always the physical sins are on the not such a big deal side, and the spiritual sins are on the it's a really big deal side. Okay? And that's been for as long as the church has thought about categories of sin, and these categories are kind of artificial, but they're helpful for us to be able to think about how these things work. And I should say, you remember we talked about Dante last week, and we talked about his falling in love and his story of love and how Beatrice called him out of himself into something greater. And the very first circle of hell is limbo, where the good pagans go. And the next circle, guess what it is? The next worst place is lust. And all the way at the very center of hell is something kind of like pride or treachery. It's, you know, Satan has three heads and he chews three traitors for all time. It's Judas Iscariot and Brutus. And then some other guy you don't know very well. And that's what he does. Satan's also a prisoner of hell. You always think of the center of hell being hot, but he flaps his wings and he's created a layer of ice that keeps him trapped there. That if he could only stop his aggression, he could perhaps escape. But he's perpetually keeping himself. Anyway, sorry. That's Dante. That's not Lewis. It's fun stuff anyway. Okay? So lust is at the top. Well, let me talk about why this is the case. The ancients recognized that the sins of the body are sins motivated by our animal nature. It's coming from your physicality. Like a key motivator is appetite, which you're not necessarily, this is the very place you're not in control of because of the fall. You have the least amount of control over these things, and therefore we should have the most extension of the most grace about these things. But sins of like pride, wrath, and envy come from within the spirit. And they are very deeply within you. They're not bodily sins in the same way. So this is why Screwtape talks about what he called the brutal love of Venus Infernal. Did you catch that? The brutal love? Maybe you read that and thought he meant like particularly like fierce, right? Or brutal as in like, it's a brutal movie, everybody dies, and that kind of stuff. He means brutal as in of the brutes, animal. Lewis uses the word brutes to mean the animal creation. And so this is a purely animalistic love. If you were to update the language, you'd say an animalistic love. And so he's leveraging the animal instinct against us. And note that what the things that Screwtape focuses on, he focuses specifically on gluttony and lust, right? He doesn't, and he tries to use gluttony and lust to make you prideful. These are the doorways, and this is the target. So once again, the thin end of the wedge is between our bodies and our spirits, so that he can do something by means of our bodies to get us in a place of culpability in our spirits. Okay, and I think Lewis is right in the broad sense about how this works in terms of our bodies and sex. Okay, let's talk about Lewis on sex, some of the stuff he writes. There is actually a whole theology on sex in Lewis's thinking. Some of it's really, really exciting in terms of how it comes together. And I'm going to give you the kind of like peppered elements. Have you any of you read the Narnia stories, The Magician's Nephew? Okay. This entire book is about sex. It's fascinating. And you've probably thought to yourself, a children's book about sex? And yes, very much so. And I'll come back and I'll explain some of why this is the case in a minute, because it's elegant. The first thing to say, no, I have one peep. We'll change it. I think we'll be okay for 20 minutes. We'll change it later. It'll help you to know that Lewis wrote the seven Narnia books, and he paired them to the seven medieval planets and didn't tell any of his friends that he'd done it. And then they complained about the books, and when they complained, he was like, fine, I won't say anything, and just left it be. But each of the books is tied to a medieval planet. The clearest example is Voyage of the Dawn Treader, tied to the sun, which was a planet at that time. Apollo is a dragon slayer. There are four dragons killed in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Gold features prominently, the color of the sun. They're on a journey toward the sun, which gets brighter and brighter as they go on. The horse and his boy is Mercury. Mercury is the messenger. The key moment is that Shasta has to carry messages. Mercury is also the metal that twins. There's sets of twins all over the place, two horses, two boys, all sorts of things happening. Lewis is playing with these images. And the magician's nephew is Venus. And Venus is all about love. And how does this work? And the primary crisis is between, well, I'm already going here. I'm going to come back, put a pin in it. It's exciting. Okay. Last week, I spoke about romantic theology, and I won't repeat that whole thing right now. But the key insight of romantic theology is that in the experiences of desire, whether for beauty or for a country or for sexual relationships or anything, that experience of desire is not itself the answer. It's drawing you towards something outside yourself and ultimately drawing you toward God. So the only true fulfillment of those desires is in your relationship with God. And the right relationship of romantic theology is to analyze these experiences and see how is this drawing me closer and closer to the only God, to the God who can fulfill these things. Okay? So our desire in sexuality is not for the sex itself. That's very important for Christians to say, but for some other good behind it. If I take the good of sexual intimacy as the end point, I've made an idol of it, and it will never satisfy. I have to have more and better and different and whatever. I have to keep pushing it forward. But if I recognize that actually this is good because it points to some other good, then I can enjoy what God has given me without chafing in these ways, chafing at the fighting against the goads. Okay, so there's something better. Physical intimacy is a waypoint toward greater union with glory. I've got this long quote from The Weight of Glory, but I will read it because I think Lewis types it, he puts it together elegantly for us. So his is in your notes. This brings me to the other sense of glory. Glory is brightness, splendor, luminosity. We are to shine as the sun. We are to be given the morning star. I think I begin to see what it means. In one way, of course, God has given us the morning star already. You can go and enjoy the gift on many fine mornings if you get up early enough. What more, you may ask, do we want? But we want so much more, something the books on aesthetics take little notice of. But the poets and the mythologies know all about it. We do not want merely to see beauty, though God knows even that is bounty enough. We want something else, which we can hardly put into words, to be united with the beauty we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become part of it. We have peopled air and earth and water with gods and goddesses and nymphs and elves, that though we cannot, yet these projections can enjoy in themselves that beauty, grace, and power of which nature is the image. For if we take the imagery of Scripture seriously, if we believe that God will one day give us the morning star and cause us to put on the splendor of the sun, then we may surmise that both the ancient myths and the modern poetry, so false as history, may be very near the truth as prophecy. At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of the morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors we see. But all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. Someday, God willing, we shall get in. When human souls have become as perfect in voluntary obedience as the inanimate creation is in its lifeless obedience, then they will put on its glory, or rather that greater glory, of which nature is only the first sketch. There's something Lewis is hinting at, the appeal of beauty outside ourselves, and he uses the word mingled. There's probably a play on words here. The Greek word for to have intercourse is mignumi. And so there's a kind of desire for intercourse with beauty, is what he's saying. You want to be unified and have an experience of union with it. Remember the picture we drew, that there's this ascent of the soul towards likeness in God, and at the end of creation, there's a union that we'd have with God. This is the goal of what we're aiming for. And that means there's something better than sex, which is at the end of creation, of which sex is a signpost, right? It's a good signpost, but it's pointing us toward that something else. And you know that something else, and Lewis says elsewhere, that something else is as unimaginable to us as being a child who loves, I don't know, who loves cookies can't imagine the benefits of like creme brulee. It's unimaginable. They have no idea the pleasures that come with maturity. And we are as the children who have no idea of the pleasures that come with our fulfillment as spiritual beings. How can we? And that's okay, just so long as we recognize there's more and don't take the little we have as the end. Okay, that's very important. A fun fact, I don't know if I deleted this or not, but you know, Morningstar is the light bringer. Luci Ferrum, it means Morningstar. Luci Ferrum, okay, the bringer of light. And of course, that's where we get our name, Lucifer, because he says, you are the bright morning star. Just to point out that there is only one morning star in the New Testament. It's Jesus, and therefore Lucifer is a name for Jesus. Okay. Did I freak you all out? That's good.
Yes.
Okay. You were the bright morning star, but we're not sure if that Ezekiel passage is actually talking about any. It could be talking about Tyre and Sidon. Anyway, when the New Testament talks about the morning star and the coming of the morning star, the morning star is the star that promises the rise of day. It's the first brightest star coming before the sun rises. And so the arrival of Jesus is the morning star because he precedes the arrival of God's coming. Okay, he's the promise of light to come. Anyway, we can talk about some of the weirdness of theological language later, but anyway, there you go. That's now every time you read it, you can have second thoughts. Lewis, in view of romantic theology, divides love in a variety of ways. I'm going to just highlight six ways that Lewis divides love. I don't have my eraser today, so I'll just flip this over. Okay, so he's got a book called The Four Loves. It's quite lovely. I've got my old copy here, The Four Loves. And he uses four Greek words to divide love. Storge is affection, the kind of ease you have with people in your home, affection. It's nice. Eros is sexual love, desire that's motivating you to be joined in sexual union with other people. Phileo is the love in friendship, right? This is the bond of, Lewis says that lovers look face to face. Friends stand side by side looking at some other thing. They're energized by the sense of togetherness in life. And then agape is divine love, God's love for us, and in Christian fulfillment, our love for one another in the community. In Lewis's thinking, all of these are good. They're all good because they're all created by God, but they have to be in their right places. So eros is good, friendship is good, agape is good, friendship is subverted. Well, I won't go too much into this. He goes into how things are subverted in a variety of different ways, and I won't have time to go through these right now. He divides eros into a pair of Venuses. So Venus, infernal, which we read about, and he doesn't really use this word, but there's Venus, I'm going to call it Venus Eternal. Okay? So I'll put it in parentheses because it's not Lewis's language. You've got some quotes here from The Four Loves. And it's written down TFL. Sorry, I didn't write out the whole book. For natural loves that are allowed to become gods do not remain loves. They are still called so, but can in fact become complicated forms of hatred. So if you idolize affection, you can weaponize it. If you idolize friendship, you can turn things into weapons, is what he's saying. if you forget to have them in order. And then he says, Eros, by his nature, invites it. Of all loves, he is at his height most godlike, therefore most prone to demand our worship. Of himself, he always tends to turn being in love into a sort of religion. And that's some of the stuff we talked about with romantic theology last week. Let me highlight a couple things from The Magician's Nephew at this point. So you've got Jadis, Queen of Charn, in this book. And she's this, when they discover her in her world, she's the only living creature in her world because she cast a spell called the Deplorable Word. And the Deplorable Word killed everyone else but saved herself. So her love serves herself only and no one else. And she's strikingly beautiful and she's regal. And when she meets Uncle Andrew, the kind of wicked, scientist, magician, he calls her a damn fine woman, sir. A dim, fine woman. She's an image of Venus Infernal, right? This infernal creature. And she creates conditions. So she goes to, she slips her way into Narnia, where Aslan creates the world, a work of, well, in the without the venereal types from the word Venus, but it just means of the sexual act of creation. Aslan creates. He gives birth through song to a world. And she's there and she tries to corrupt it. And then she plays a war between Diggory. So young Diggory is given a choice. Young Diggory is this boy whose mother is dying. And Jadis says, she says, you can sacrifice Narnia and save your mother. It's the same choice she made, right? Go steal the apple and give it to your mom and then she'll survive. And now Diggory is torn between his right love for his mother, a Venus terrestrial, and his corrupted love for Jadis, and his love for what's happening around him. It's really quite sophisticated how Lewis plays it together. Where does he find the apple? In a locked garden. Gardens are images for marital union. I mean, it's really, I'm telling you, it's quite sophisticated stuff. You thought it was just a good story. The miracle of Lewis is that it's still a good story, even though it's filled with all this really quite profound imagery. Okay? So Venus Infernal is the Venus who is appealing to our animal nature to in order to subvert our spiritual lives. Venus Eternal is the spiritual love that's drawing us out of ourselves into a more charitable and godlike relationship with ourselves, one another, and our world. Okay, both of them are a kind of Eros. Okay, Screwtape, like I said, speaks to this division explicitly. I won't read it again. You've got 22 on your papers right there. He's describing the Venus Infernal in that space. Okay, let's talk about sex, our culture and sex. So Screwtape's influence has worked. Something is now very wrong with how we understand sexual desire in the modern world. The ancient world, up to very recently, could see it as mostly harmless. Like, it was wrong, but it wasn't the worst thing. But something has gone significantly wrong. And I want to read this next passage from Mere Christianity, a chapter called Sexual Morality. They tell you sex has become a mess because it was hushed up. But for the last 20 years, it has not been hushed up. It has been chattered about all day long. Yet it is still a mess. If hushing up had been the cause of the trouble, ventilation would have set it right. But it has not. I think it is the other way around. I think the human race originally hushed it up because it had become such a mess. Modern people are always saying, sex is nothing to be ashamed of. They may mean two things. They may mean there is nothing to be ashamed of in the fact that the human race reproduces itself in a certain way, nor in the fact that it gives pleasure. If they mean that, they are right. Christianity says the same. It is not the thing nor the pleasure that is the trouble. The old Christian teachers said that if man had never fallen, sexual pleasure, instead of being less than it is now, would actually have been greater. I know some muddle-headed Christians have talked as if Christianity thought that sex or the body or pleasure were bad in themselves, but they were wrong. Christianity is almost the only one of the great religions which thoroughly approves of the body, which believes that matter is good, that God himself once took on a human body, that some kind of body is going to be given to us in heaven, even in heaven, and is going to be an essential part of our happiness, our beauty, and our energy. Christianity has glorified marriage more than any other religion, and nearly all the greatest love poetry in the world has been produced by Christians. If anyone says that sex in itself is bad, Christianity contradicts him at once. But of course, when people say sex has nothing to be ashamed of, they may mean the state into which the sexual instinct has now got is nothing to be ashamed of. If they mean that, I think they are wrong. Okay. So I don't need to unpack a lot, but Lewis is quite clear, and I think he's exactly right. The body is good. Sex is good. He invented it. It was his idea. We could have created more humans with like an unpleasurable handshake or a conversation, right? There's all sorts of ways. He chose to make it fun for his own good pleasure. And so that was his idea. You could blame him for it if you like. But understanding that, I think we get to say it's good, but we need to have it in the right proportions, the right relations to other things. Okay? So let me I'm going to pull aside for a second and just talk about a few ways that Lewis's view of sexuality critiques our modern world. I'll just make three brief points. There are a generation of men and women who have fixated on sexual sin as the chiefest of sins. Why generation? That has been the main thing. And chiefly as far, in my lifetime, and before, probably 20 years before my lifetime and until now, the main focus has been on things like pornography and homosexuality. That's been those are the big sins. Those are the big problems. But in the process, they became prideful and malicious toward others. The sexual purity movement in North America as well, right? The saving sex for marriage. What is so interesting is how there's been a knock-on effect of like anxiety and rejection because of these things. And it's very interesting how it really created a kind of idol of heterosexual marriage. You're not fully formed as a Christian until you're in a heterosexual marriage and you have at least one child, right? Like, there's a kind of subtlety. I mean, I've been in churches where the singles groups are just basically dating mixers, right? They're trying to get all the free electrons hooked up in the process. Okay. Lewis's understanding, second, gives us a way to critique the idolatry of heterosexual marriage. We are made, and we know we are made for a different, greater glory. And while we affirm that heterosexual marriage is the only biblical ground for sexual expression, it is not an end in itself. It always points somewhere else. We have to have an understanding in the church that there are chaste singles who are every bit as valuable and contributory, and they're not deformed or malformed in any way. That's very important. We have to understand that, yes, we uphold marriage, but we also, our sense of family is all together as a church. There's some really important things to recognize in that. And then third, Lewis helps us in terms of same-sex attraction. If you think about romantic theology, in response to this, we can validate the desire. Your desire is great. God loves you. Your desire for union is great, but you can't find satisfaction where you want it, any more than I will find satisfaction from my desire in what is my permissible heterosexual activity. If I say that I'm getting satisfied, like I'm finding fulfillment of these desires, if I've attached my hopes on these things, then I've lied to people. Okay. So we can bring people in, we can validate their desires for more, and we can point them ultimately towards God. I think it's more pastoral and more loving. This next quote is not in your notes, but I read it afterwards, and I want to read it for you now. This is also from Mere Christianity, Sexual Morality. Lewis says, finally, though I have had to speak at some length about sex, I want to make it as clear as I possibly can that the center of Christian morality is not here. If anyone thinks that Christians regard unchastity as the supreme vice, he is quite wrong. The sins of the flesh are bad, but they are the least bad of all sins. All the worst pleasures are purely spiritual. But pleasure putting other people in the wrong, of bossing and patronizing and spoiled sport, of backbiting, the pleasures of power, of hatred. For there are two things inside me competing with the human self which I must try to become. They are the animal self and the diabolical self. The diabolical self is the worst of the two. That is why a cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute. But of course, it is better to be neither. Okay. A cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute. If you are cold and malicious and self-righteous in your sense of your identity and purity, then you are worse off than someone who's simply honest about their sin. Full stop. Because not all sins are equal in their effects. And if Screwtape can, as the devil can, as I think he has succeeded in doing, make us priggish about sex and neglect the sins of pride that are in our hearts, then he's succeeded. But of course, it's better to be neither, right? It's better to be honest and open about our sinfulness. Okay, I'm going to highlight a couple defenses against sexual temptation, both coming from Lewis. One of them is to honor the nature of the garden. Honor the nature of the garden. You know what? Boundaries are really good. Boundaries are wholesome. Boundaries create beauty. A garden, how many, some, I won't mind this at the moment. Many of you garden, many of you realize how little time it takes for your garden to go to seed. Constant maintenance, constant work, constant attention. That the beauty of the garden depends a great deal on the work of the gardener to protect the garden. And boundaries in sexuality protect the beauty of sexuality. It's the same thing. Here's what Lewis writes in The Four Loves. It is no disparagement to a garden to say that it will not fence and weed itself, nor prune its own fruit trees, nor roll and cut its own lawns. A garden is a good thing, but that is not the sort of goodness that it has. It will remain a garden as distinct from a wilderness only if someone does all these things to it. Its real glory is of quite a different kind. The very fact that it needs constant weeding and pruning bears witness to the glory. It teems with life. It glows with color and smells like heaven and puts forward every hour of a summer day beauties which man could never have created and could not even on his own resources have imagined. If you want to see the difference between its contribution and the gardener's, put the commonest weed it grows side by side with a hoax, raise, shears, and packet of weed killer. You would put beauty, energy, and fecundity beside dead, sterile things. Just so our decency and common sense show gray and death-like beside the geniality of love. And when the garden is in its full glory, the gardener's contributions to that glory will have still been, in a sense, paltry compared with those of nature. The smallest bit of love compared to the tools of gardening are, you know, the smallest bit of a garden compared to the tools, one is beautiful and one is, you know, rusty and a blister-inducing is what I want to say, right? But they don't exist without each other. And the fullness of beauty requires that boundary. And so sometimes the things we call decency and common sense in terms of Christian sexual morality, yeah, they're boring and they're dull and they don't look fun. But it's like surveying the gardener's tool and then complaining about the garden. The two things go together. Okay, honor the nature of the garden. Second thing Lewis recommends as a weapon is humor. We need to put physicality in its proportion. Nakedness is funny. I won't demonstrate that for you right now, okay? Nakedness is funny. The naked human form is ridiculous. And if we've lost our ability to kind of, if we can laugh at it, so much of the sexual power of it's removed. How many of you have seen Waking Ned Divine? The end of the movie has him on a naked motorcycle ride through the Irish countryside. It is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Because, of course, he has the strip of mud up his backside while he's going along. It's not sexualized. What is it about nakedness that we can recognize it without having immediately to have it sexualized for us? Something's wrong with us that we can't laugh at these things. Lewis says of the quotes at the outset of Screwtape, I won't read them again, you know, we mock the devil by laughing at him. Malcolm Muggeridge says that sex is the only mysticism of a materialist age, the only mysticism, the only mysticism extension outside of yourself. The greatest experience I can have is, if this world is all there is, the greatest experience I can have is an orgasm. That's it. There's nothing greater, nothing higher. Humor puts a pin to that balloon, doesn't it? Right? Maybe not. Right? And there's laughter there, and we begin to realize it's not the end all, is it? What a ridiculous sentiment to have. But we need to be able to laugh at these things. The Four Loves, Lewis says, I believe we are all being encouraged to take Venus too seriously, at any rate with the wrong kind of seriousness. All my life, a ludicrous and portentous solemnization of sex has been going on. And then he goes on to say, we must not be totally serious about Venus. Indeed, we can't be totally serious without doing violence to our humanity. It is not for nothing that every language and literature in the world is full of jokes about sex. Many of them may be dull or disgusting, and nearly all of them are old but we must insist that they embody an attitude to Venus which in the long run endangers the Christian life far less than reverential gravity. We must not attempt to find an absolute in the flesh. Banish play and laughter from the bed of love, and you let in a false goddess. So laughter is one of the ways that we let air out of the balloon of the intensity of these things, and I think there's something important there. Let me just highlight a few notes from Shakespeare, from Screwtape. Yeah, very different books. Although Shakespeare does laugh a lot. Oh, my goodness. Never mind. I'll say this later. Okay. From letter 9, the attack has a much better chance of success when the whole man's inner world is drab and cold and empty. What does he mean? He means when you are feeling empty, then pleasure becomes an opportunity to attack you because it'll make you feel something. Making you feel something, he can deceive you. Therefore, he says, same letter, all we can do is encourage the humans to take the pleasures which our enemy has produced at times or in ways or in degrees which he has forbidden. The pleasure is good. Remember what he's talking about? We can't create a pleasure. All our efforts and works have tried. We can't create anything. He says he's got all the pleasures, pleasures forevermore. And I think we can rejoice in that. Real pleasure is with our God. Okay. Letter 17. On that, as on every other subject, keep your man in a condition of false spirituality. So focus on pride rather than on the animal awareness of himself. And letter 19, instill into him an overweening asceticism. And then when you have separated his sexuality from all that might humanize it, weigh in on him with it in some much more brutal and cynical form. Brutal and cynical form. More animalistic. So separate sexuality from all that might humanize it. Remove it from the humanizing, meaning the perfect union of the spiritual and the animal. Make it purely animal, and then you can make him more prideful and make the sex more animal. And in the process, there's a disintegration of the person. Okay, your head's full. Ready to go home? Okay. Let's take five, visit the restroom, get some water, and then we'll come back. And you guys, I've got some, I'll give you coaching on the questions when you come back.